CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
President Trump has ceded the presidency to Elon Musk. No, no, that's not happening.
The Republican-led Congress rejects a last-minute demand for a debt limit suspension from President-elect Donald Trump and his billionaire advisor Elon Musk, who many are calling President Musk. We'll speak with the American Prospect editor Robert Kuttner. He says Musk outmaneuvered Trump. Then, merci Gisèle. That was the nationwide response in France to Gisèle Pelicot, the 72-year-old French woman whose landmark rape case galvanized France. On Thursday, her husband and 50 other men were sentenced for raping her for more than a decade. She insisted on dropping her anonymity.
I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle.
We'll speak with the French journalist Diane de Vignemont. She covered the Avignon trial and wrote about finding sisterhood at France's mass rape trial. Then to Bethlehem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
We said last year, Christ is in the rubble. And this year we say, Christ is still in the rubble. The rubble is his manger. Jesus finds his place with the marginalized, the tormented, the oppressed, and the displaced. We look at the Holy Family and see them in every displaced and homeless family living in despair.
We'll speak with and hear part of the Christmas address of Reverend Mother Isaac, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden has spared the lives of 37 men on federal death row. Earlier today, Biden commuted their sentences to life without parole just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House. In a statement, Biden said, quote, I am more convinced than ever that we must stop the use of the death penalty at the federal level. In good conscience, I cannot stand back and let a new administration resume executions that I halted, unquote. Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, praised Biden's decision, calling it, quote, an important turning point in ending America's tragic and error-prone use of the death penalty, unquote. Biden did not commute the sentences of three men on federal death row. Dylan Roof, who killed nine black parishioners at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. And Robert Bowers, who attacked the Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, killing 11 congregants in the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. The head of the U.N. Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, has accused Israel of escalating attacks across the Gaza Strip. UNRWA head Philippe Lazzarini said, quote, attacks on schools and hospitals have been commonplace. The world must not become numb. All wars have rules. All of those rules have been broken, unquote. On Friday, an Israeli airstrike on the Jabalia refugee camp killed 12 members of a family, including seven children. In a separate attack Friday, an Israeli drone struck a residential building in the Nuseirat refugee camp, killing at least eight people. Overnight, Israeli drones attacked the so-called safe zone of Al-Mawasi, killing at least 11 people and setting tents on fire. In northern Gaza, Israel continues to attack Kamal Adwan Hospital. Israel's used tanks, snipers, and quadcopters to attack the medical center where over 400 civilians have sought medical care and shelter. This is Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital.
We do not know why we are being bombed, and we do not know why we are being targeted in this way. Despite us asking the world for international protection, we continue to appeal to the world and remind them that there are Geneva Conventions that the world sings praises of. This includes the protection of the healthcare system and the protection of hospital staff. Up until this moment, unfortunately, we are being targeted in full view of the entire world, but unfortunately falling on deaf ears.
This comes as a new report by Oxfam finds just 12 aid trucks have managed to distribute aid to starving Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza over the past 2.5 months. In three cases, Israel shelled schools, turned shelters just hours after aid was delivered. On Saturday, Pope Francis condemned what he called the cruelty of Israel's bombardment of Gaza.
Cardinal Rey parlato della guerra.
Cardinal Rey spoke about the war yesterday. They did not let the patriarch enter into Gaza as they had promised. And yesterday, children were bombed. This is cruelty. This is not war. I wanted to say this because it touches the heart.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is currently on trial for corruption in Israel. Turkey's foreign minister traveled to Damascus Sunday to meet with Syria's new de facto ruler, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the head of the Islamist group HTS that toppled the Assad regime. According to press accounts, they discussed the need for Syria to draft a new constitution, the future of the Kurds, and Israel's attacks on Syrian sovereignty. Meanwhile, the Biden administration's moving to lift a $10 million bounty the U.S. had placed on al-Sharaa over his links to al-Qaeda. On Friday, a U.S. delegation met with him in Damascus. The foreign ministers of Jordan and Qatar are in the Syrian capital for meetings today. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's acknowledged there are now about 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, more than double the previously announced figure of 900. Over the weekend, Congress reached a deal to avert a federal shutdown by passing a slimmed-down temporary government spending plan that'll fund the government until mid-March. The final vote came days after the world's richest man and Trump advisor Elon Musk helped torpedo an earlier version of the spending bill that had been negotiated by the Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. Several key initiatives were then removed from the bill, including $190 million for children's cancer research. A provision to suspend the debt ceiling was also removed, despite that being a top demand of President-elect Trump. Biden signed the new funding legislation on Saturday. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The House Ethics Committee has determined former Florida Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz committed statutory rape involving a 17-year-old high school student who he paid to have sex with. The 37-page ethics report is expected to be formally released today. CBS obtained a leaked version of the report, which states, quote, "The committee determined there is substantial evidence that Representative Gaetz violated House rules and other standards of conduct prohibiting prostitution, statutory rape, illicit drug use, impermissible gifts, special favors or privileges, and obstruction of Congress," unquote. Last month, Donald Trump picked Gaetz to be his attorney general, but Gaetz stepped aside as outrage grew over his selection. President-elect Trump has threatened to retake the Panama Canal if Panama doesn't lower fees for U.S. ships. The United States controlled the waterway since the early 20th century, but in 1977, President Jimmy Carter signed a landmark treaty to give Panama control of the canal. Trump made the threat during a speech Sunday in Arizona.
If the principles, both moral and legal, of this magnanimous gesture of giving are not followed, then we will demand that the Panama Canal be returned to the United States of America in full, quickly, and without question.
Panama's president, Jose Raul Mulino, rejected Trump's threat in a video posted online.
I want to express that every square meter of the Panama Canal and its adjacent areas belong to Panama and will continue to belong to Panama. The sovereignty and independence of our country are not negotiable.
On Sunday, President-elect Trump also posted a message online saying the United States should take ownership of Greenland, which is controlled by Denmark. Trump wrote, quote, "For purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the United States of America feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity," unquote. Trump's statement on Greenland was made as he announced he was picking PayPal co-founder Ken Howery as his pick for United States ambassador to Denmark. Germany's in mourning after a man drove his car into a Christmas market in the city of Magdeburg. Four women and a 9-year-old boy were killed. About 200 people were injured. Police arrested a Saudi-born man who had a long history of posting messages on social media criticizing his former faith of Islam while voicing support for the far-right anti-immigrant AFD. That's Alternative for Germany Party. Saudi Arabia had once warned Germany that the man, Talib al-Abdulmohsen, posed a threat. In other German-related news, the world's richest man, Elon Musk, has weighed into German politics ahead of their upcoming elections by also supporting the far-right AFD. Early on Friday, Musk posted a message on his platform X that read, quote, "Only the AFD can save Germany." The Inter-American Court of Human Rights has ruled against El Salvador in a historic abortion case. The court ruled El Salvador violated the rights of a woman named Beatriz, who was denied an abortion in 2013, even though her life was in danger due to her high-risk pregnancy. The court ordered El Salvador to allow doctors to perform abortions in cases of, quote, pregnancies that pose a risk to the woman's life and health. El Salvador has one of the strictest abortion bans in the world. In San Salvador, women celebrated the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruling.
We've received numerous messages globally. I want to express gratitude for the immense solidarity and celebrate this decision towards us women. It's a victory for the feminist movement, which has stood by Beatriz's case for 11 years.
In another major decision, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has ruled the nation of Colombia violated the rights of the Uwa indigenous people by authorizing oil, gas, and mining projects on their land. The group Earth Rights International said the historic decision could set a precedent for the protection of indigenous peoples in Colombia and across Latin America. The court determined Colombia had an obligation to consult indigenous peoples about extractive projects that may affect them. A new investigation by the Washington Post has determined that more than 3,100 indigenous students died at boarding schools in the United States between 1828 and 1970. That figure is three times the number of deaths reported earlier this year by the U.S. Interior Department. The Post's year-long investigation also found more than 800 students were buried in cemeteries at or near the schools, which were designed to crush Native American culture. Many of the children had been forcibly removed from their families and tribes. The top uniformed police officer in New York City has resigned after coming under investigation that he repeatedly pressured female officers to have sex with him. Jeffrey Madry had served as chief of department since he was appointed in 2022 by his close friend, New York Mayor Eric Adams. One New York police lieutenant said Madry exploited her emotional and financial vulnerabilities to coerce her into sex in exchange for opportunities to make extra money by working overtime. And the Times of Israel is reporting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is planning to skip a major event in Poland next month to mark 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz, out of fears he might be arrested for committing war crimes in Gaza. In November, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu, as well as his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Poland's deputy foreign minister recently confirmed Poland would comply with the ICC arrest warrants if Netanyahu visits Poland. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with the stopgap legislation passed Friday by the Republican-controlled House that averted a government shutdown and also rejected a last-minute demand for a debt limit suspension from President-elect Donald Trump and his billionaire advisor Elon Musk, who many are calling President Musk. Biden signed the measure Saturday morning. Funding for pediatric cancer research that was cut from the final bill was passed in the Senate as a separate measure after outrage over the move. The spending bill will keep federal funding at current levels through mid-March and provides $100 billion in disaster aid and $10 billion in assistance to farmers. It came after the original spending bill based on Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's deal with Democrats was rejected when Trump's billionaire advisor Elon Musk objected to it. Musk, the world's richest man, warned on his platform X that any lawmaker who supported the spending bill, quote, deserves to be voted out in 2 years. And he said he would fund the primarying of those Congress members. After the House voted to avert the government shutdown, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said he thought both Trump and Musk were happy with it.
I was in constant contact with President Trump throughout this process, spoke with him most recently about 45 minutes ago. He knew exactly what we were doing and why, and this is a good outcome for the country. I think he certainly is happy about this outcome as well. Elon Musk and I talked within about an hour ago, and we talked about the extraordinary challenges of this job. And I said, hey, you want to be Speaker of the House? I don't know. He said, this may be the hardest job in the world. I think it is. But we're going to get through this.
Well, meanwhile, in a speech at the conservative group Turning Point USA's conference called America First, President-elect Trump tried to joke about how Musk had flexed his political power.
No, he's not taking the presidency. I like having smart people. You know, they're on a new kick. Russia, 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 Ukraine, 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 all the different hoaxes. And the new one is President Trump has ceded the presidency to Elon Musk. No, no, that's not happening. But Elon's done an amazing job. Isn't it nice to have smart people that we can rely on?
President-elect Trump was addressing Turning Point in their conference, America Fest. For more, we're joined by Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He has been following this story very closely. His recent piece, How Musk Outmaneuvered Trump, his latest book, Going Big, FDR's Legacy, Biden's New Deal, and the Struggle to Save Democracy. Robert Kuttner, welcome back to Democracy Now! So why do you think Musk outmaneuvered Trump here? And talk about what was passed.
So if you go back to last Tuesday, Johnson and the Democrats had agreed on a bill to continue funding the government, and it had about 100 other bipartisan provisions in it, including, and this was the one that was most important to Musk, a provision that had been negotiated by Senator Cornyn of Texas, a Republican, and Senator Casey of Pennsylvania, a Democrat, to limit high-tech investments in China for national security purposes. Now, it just happens that Elon Musk has Tesla factories in China and is planning AI in China. And a ban on high-tech exports would have really messed with his whole business strategy centered on China. It was at that point that Musk begins this Twitter storm of more than 100 tweets warning that this bill is too expensive, that it's outrageous, that it contains, you know, a 40% pay raise for Congress, and a whole bunch of things that just weren't true. This was all a smokescreen to get Congress to kill the bill because it had this China provision that would have cost Musk a lot of money. So about 12 hours after that, Trump, who had been silent about the bill, clamors on board and says, you know, there's a terrible bill and you need to change it so that it includes a provision waiving the temporary debt ceiling. Well, by Thursday, the bill was dead. They had to negotiate a whole new bill. And at the end of the day, Congress wanted to go home for Christmas. And so it passes overwhelmingly. But in the meantime, 38 Republicans had refused to get on board with this waiver of the debt ceiling. The Democrats were never going to give Trump that kind of leverage. So the Democrats were never going to vote for a waiver of the debt ceiling. Trump must have known that. End of the day, Musk got exactly what he wanted. The China provision was stripped from the bill. Trump did not get what he wanted. The waiver was not included in the bill. And so it's a classic case of Musk rolling Trump. And so there are a couple of questions here. Is Trump aware of this? Is he whistling past the graveyard? as that comment suggested. He's not stupid. He may be evil, but he's not stupid. And he must know that Trump, that Musk took him to the cleaners on this, and that this is going to happen going forward, right? I mean, Trump is supposed to be some kind of a China hawk. So there are going to be all kinds of conflicts between what Trump wants to do and what's good for Musk's business interest. And these are both narcissistic guys. I argue that there's room for only one scorpion in this bottle, and that at some point, Musk is going to overplay his hand and Trump is going to get sick of him. The other point I want to make is that the media, the mainstream media, completely missed this story. The mainstream media has played this as is Johnson in trouble, and why the bipartisanship didn't work and what that portends going forward. And not a single mainstream media outlet, with the exception of a kind of minor reference by E.J. Dionne and a very nice discussion of it by Heather Cox Richardson, the mainstream media did not touch this story at all. Politico had another characteristically stupid piece this morning on this is all about whether Trump can control Johnson. That's not what it's all about at all. A deal that included a waiver of the debt ceiling was never in the cards. There were never the votes for that. There were 38 fiscally conservative Republicans who weren't going to vote for it. The Democrats were never going to vote for it. And by the way, the threat to primary those Republicans, most of those are in very, very safe seats. So again, Musk is going to demonstrate that this particular threat is just idle bluster. And the other interesting thing here is that unintentionally, this puts a little bit of spine in the Republican caucus in the House and the Senate. They're willing to eat a lot of crow for Trump, but at some point, even the spineless Republicans in the House and Senate get sick of being treated as nothing but rubber stamps.
So, Robert Kuttner, talk about Democratic House leader, I mean, the leader of the minority, Hakeem Jeffries, allegedly discussing permanently abolishing the debt ceiling. Can you talk about the significance of this discussion? And because it's just referred to as the debt ceiling or eliminating it, explain exactly what it is.
Okay. So, in the early 20th century, legislation was passed requiring Congress to explicitly pass a law increasing the permissible amount of the national debt. Up until then, Congress could pass whatever it wanted to. And if Congress passed deficit funding and that temporarily increased the national debt, that was just the way it was. It was assumed that because Congress had voted to increase the deficit and that temporarily increased the national debt, that took care of it. And then during World War One, they decided, well, when the government was borrowing a lot of money to prosecute the war, they decided, no, there ought to be a separate vote extending the debt ceiling. And for a long time, this was just pro forma. And then beginning in the 80s and 90s, Republicans used this as a cudgel to threaten that government shutdown if Democrats would not cut particular spending programs. And for about 40 years, the ritual of, you know, are we going to fall off a cliff and shut down the government, or are they going to some kind of compromise and extend the debt ceiling? That has been a part of American fiscal politics. So at various points, various Democrats and various Republicans have said, you know, this is silly. This is a distraction. Let's get rid of it. And when the Democrats have wanted to get rid of it, the Republicans have said, oh, no, 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 we're not going to give up that leverage, and vice versa. So in this context, when Trump is about to become president and Musk is talking about cutting $2 billion worth of social programs, there aren't even $2 billion, trillion dollars worth of social programs. Tactically, this is not the moment for the Democrats to give this up. So I think Jeffries sort of talked about this as some part of some kind of grand bargain in the future, but not in this particular moment.
Can you talk about what the Republicans cut out in the House? I mean, this astounding, $190 million for pediatric cancer research. and then what the Senate did to fix that. But what exactly this means?
Well, there were about 100 provisions, bipartisan provisions, that had been painstakingly negotiated in good faith across the aisle by Republicans and Democrats that were part of the budget deal that Musk succeeded in killing. The Senate managed to restore, I think, 4 of them. They restored some farm relief. They restored some disaster aid. They restored some funding for pediatric cancer research, and I think there was one other relief measure. But the other 96 were on the cutting room floor, and those included, you know, a very small token raise for Congress. I think cost of living raise of 2.5%. Musk, in his Twitter storm, described this as a 40% raise, and there were lots of other good pieces of legislation. The most important of which was this China provision that, you know, people concerned with national security exports of militarily sensitive technologies to China have been trying to get for a long time. This is bipartisan. And that and all these other provisions were just left out of the bill because the final bill was what's called a continuing resolution. Let's just fund the government at the same level until the middle of March. And then the Senate did succeed in restoring these 3 or 4 provisions.
And I also wanted to ask you about Elon Musk and his interests here. I mean, if he wields this much power and people talk about, well, he's not even elected, he doesn't want to be elected because he would have to abide by some conflict of interest laws. You've got him holding over $15 billion in federal contracts through SpaceX, Tesla, Neuralink companies. Talk about the significance of this and how he benefits by what he pushes for.
Well, the really interesting thing is if you can imagine Musk playing this game at Trump's expense one time too often, and then you say to yourself, okay, going forward, can Trump, like he's done with so many other people, simply say, you're fired? Or does Musk have too much leverage over Trump? Or conversely, does Trump have a lot of leverage over Musk? So if Musk became Trump's enemy, that could do a lot of damage to Trump. On the other hand, Musk is dependent on all these government contracts. NASA has basically been outsourced to Musk, right? He makes a ton of money on all of these rocket launches through his company, SpaceX. He also controls a lot of battlefield satellite technology on which the Pentagon is dependent. And that cuts both ways. A lot of people at the Pentagon think this is terrible. They want to come up with some other vendors so they're not so totally dependent on Musk, who sometimes has his own foreign policy. I mean, Ukraine battlefield communications were dependent on Starlink. And Musk started saying, well, I don't like the fact that you're doing this inside Russia, so maybe I'm not going to let you use Starlink. So not only does he have his own independent fiscal policy, he's got his own independent foreign policy. So if you play this forward, at some point, Trump decides that, wait a minute, this guy has too much power. He's upstaging me. He's promoting some things that are at odds with my own agenda. And then Musk can say, well, look, I got 6 different ways I can screw you. And I was looking back at history. I could not find another single case in the entire annals of world history where another leader who had dictatorial ambitions put somebody who he didn't control in such a position of power. So I don't think this is going to end well. And how exactly it ends will be fascinating to watch. And there's useful collateral damage here, which, as I said a moment ago, is that Republicans in Congress, both the House and the Senate, you know, are getting a little bit weary of this, too. You don't threaten 38 members of the Republican House who have the safest Republican seats without getting some kind of backlash. And you don't appoint a clown car to key cabinet offices without getting some kind of backlash, even from Republican senators. So,
Bob Kuttner, I want to go to my last question because we have to wrap in a minute. And that is the article you just wrote for American Prospect headlined How AARP Shills for United Healthcare, in which you ask, why does the supposed advocate for the elderly steer them to the industry's worst insurer? In this last minute, lay out what you found.
Well, it's a very simple answer. They get $1 billion a year in kickbacks from United. And if they were doing their job, they would do some research on 7 or 8 different insurers, and they would say, here are the pros and cons of this one and that one. But the only insurance company that they are co-branded with is United Healthcare, and they get about $250 million a year in dues. They get 4 times that in kickbacks from United. Some people might say this is a sham nonprofit. It's really an insurance marketing scheme disguised as an organization for the elderly, and I'm going to be following up on that.
Well, Bob Cutner, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Robert Cutner is co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. We'll link to your piece, How Musk Outmaneuvered Trump. He's also a professor at Brandeis University. When we come back, we'll speak with a French journalist who says she found sisterhood as she covered the rape trial of Gisèle Pelicot. She's the 72-year-old French woman whose landmark rape case galvanized France when she insisted on dropping her anonymity. On Friday, Pelicot's husband Dominique and 50 other men were sentenced for raping her for more than a decade. Back in 20 seconds.
Sommes sans passé, les femmes, nous qui n'avons pas d'histoire. Depuis la nuit des temps, les femmes, nous sommes le continent noir. Nous femmes esclaves et brisons nos entraves. Debout, debout, asservies. Les femmes achetées, vendues, violées. Dans toutes les maisons, les femmes hors du monde reléguées. Levons-nous, femmes esclaves, et brisons nos entraves.
Compagnie Jolimont, singing l'hymne des femmes, the women's anthem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Merci, Gisèle. That was the nationwide response in France to Gisèle Pelicot, the 72-year-old French woman whose landmark rape case galvanized France. On Friday, her husband and about 50 other men were declared guilty and sentenced for repeatedly raping her for more than a decade after he drugged her unconscious. A panel of judges sentenced Dominique Pelicot to the maximum 20 years in prison. The shocking case made headlines around the world. The 3.5-month trial gripped France, with supporters regularly gathering around the Avignon Palais de Justice courthouse to support Gisèle Pelicot, who famously waived anonymity to give a voice to survivors and change the public discourse on sexual violence. She told the court during the trial, quote, "It's not for us to feel shame. It's for them," she said. She also insisted videos of her rapes that her husband had taken when she was fast asleep, drugged into sleep, that these videotapes be shown in the court as part of the trial. Gisèle Pelicot spoke after the sentencing on Friday.
I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle. I wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who've supported me throughout this ordeal. Your testimonies devastated me, and I was able to pull the strength from them to come back every day to face these long days of the trial.
Meanwhile, some women's rights activists supporting Gisèle Pelicot said they were disappointed with the verdict. This is Muriel Chirchet from the French feminist collective Nous Toutes, Us All.
Les viols, finalement, enfin, pour les crimes, on peut prendre perpète avec...
For crimes, you can get a life sentence without parole for 22 years. And with rape, no. And yet, rape destroys lives. We spend our lives trying to get over it. There are secondary victims who have not even been taken into account. And so the minimum needed was to hit very hard with this justice. Really very, very, very disappointed. Very disappointed. And once again... Well, our thoughts go especially to Giselle. To Giselle, who we will never thank enough. And on top of that, this verdict is a spit in the face. I have no other words.
For more, we're joined by Diane de Vignemont, a French journalist who covered the trial in Avignon. Her November piece for New Lines magazine is headlined Giselle Pellicot, Finding Sisterhood at France's Mass Rape Trial. She's based in Paris, but she just flew into New York. It's great to have you in studio. Welcome to Democracy Now, Diane. Explain the significance of this trial and the bravery of the 72-year-old woman who did something that most women in France, I mean, most do not bring cases against their rapists, but what happens when they go to trial even?
Hi, thanks for having me. So yes, the case is definitely exceptional, not only in the acts themselves, you know, the raping of a woman over 10 years by so many men, but also by the fact that Giselle decided to make it public. She waived her right to an anonymity, which most women in a rape case chose not to do, especially when the video evidence is so graphic.
And just for people who didn't follow this case, how can it be 50 men? In fact, it was something like 70, right? What happened over this decade, and how was Dominique Pellicot, her husband, found out?
Of course. So, yes, so it's 70 men, 20, so 20 of whom were not identified because the videos don't show their face. But Pellicot began drugging her, that we know of, 10 years ago with sleeping pills. And he recruited men on a website called Coco, where people do go for libertinage, so like swingers website. And he created a chat room called Against Her Will, à son insu, without her knowledge. And there he recruited men to come in and have sex with his wife. Some of them he did warn that she was taking sleeping pills. Most of them he said to that she was consenting to her sleeping pills. This was a game that they like to take part in as a couple.
That she was faking it?
Yes.
That she was faking she was sleeping?
No, that she was taking the sleeping pills herself because this is something that she liked and enjoyed. And you can see him on the videos egging the men on by telling them that she likes it, she enjoys it, she wants more.
And yet you hear in the video this horrific drone of her snoring to see how deeply drugged she was.
Really, really intense. Snoring to the point that one of the accused said that he had tinnitus and he had bad hearing, which is why he didn't hear her snore, and that was his defense. But you can very, very much hear her snoring. And he recruited them online, and there was a whole process that they had to go through so that she wouldn't know in the morning that she'd been raped. So they had to not smoke, not wear cologne, cut their nails short, take their clothes off in the hallway, warm their hands before touching her, so that, one, she wouldn't wake up, and two, she wouldn't know the next morning that she'd been raped.
So she finds out about this because her husband is caught at a grocery store, what it's called upskirting, trying to take pictures with his cell phone up women's skirts.
Exactly.
And the police come to the house and take his hard drive, and that's where they find thousands of videos and photographs of something completely different.
Yeah.
His wife being raped.
He's caught upskirting. They convince the vigil who caught him upskirting has to really convince one of the women to go to the police with us. She doesn't want to, but he pushes her to. And because he's arrested, they get to go through his phone. And because he's in police custody, they also get to go to his home. And that's where they find the hard drive, where he had a folder titled Abuse, where he'd methodically cataloged every single video over 10 years. Videos with the name of the rapist, videos with the name of the act. And
then you have his children, her children, their children, what, two boys and a girl, mm-hmm. and then they have grandchildren, saying something's wrong with mom. She is forgetting everything. She is, and the husband, who's the rapist and recruiting everyone else to rape her, takes her to the doctor because she's losing her memory. But this is from being heavily drugged.
Exactly. She wakes up one morning, looks at herself in the mirror, and she's got a haircut that she doesn't remember getting. She goes to her hairdressers to apologize, and they say, yeah, you seemed very odd, like you were out of it. And so she, for 10 years, was consulting doctor after doctor after doctor to find out what she was wrong with her. She thought she had only early onset Alzheimer's, but no doctor could figure out what was wrong with her. Her doctor, her husband, kept taking her and kept, you know, making quips about, you know, what are you doing that you're so tired? What are you doing at night? And so, yeah, that's maybe one of the things that will be beneficial after this case, is that doctors will know to watch out for the symptoms of chemical submission.
So if you can talk about that moment when she decides, I am not going to be anonymous, I'm going to flip this script, I am not ashamed, I didn't do this, I was the victim, when she took off her sunglasses, allowed the videos to be made public.
So yeah, from the testimonies of her daughter and of the new reporters who first followed the case when it came out in 2021, at first she was very, very scared of the publicity. Her name in the article in 2021 is not given, and she spends about 2 years in hiding. And then little by little, as her lawyers tell her that she has to watch the videos ahead of time, she has to prepare herself for what's going to be shown on trial, she starts watching the video with her lawyers. And that's when she gets progressively angrier and decides not only that she's going to make it public, but that she's also going to fight the court to make it public, because they're very, very opposed to it originally. So it's not just her deciding, but it's her fighting for it. For a few weeks, the court took back the publicity of the trial. For a few weeks, it was closed.
Talk about the scene in Avignon outside the courthouse, the women there and all over who started to rally around her.
Yeah, so you have to get there very, very early. So the court opens at 8, but you have to be there at 7 at the latest to line up by the courthouse. And there's a side room where the public can go. But there's only 60 seats in the courthouse. And the day I went, 30 of them was reserved for journalists, because increasingly journalists were coming in from all over the world. There were, I think, 175 that day. And so the women are lining up, and I found it really extraordinary in line, sort of a sorority that immediately appeared. Women that I had met 2 minutes ago were telling me about why they were here, telling me about their raves, telling me with their experience with chemical submission, being drugged one night, waking up in a strange bed, and sort of circles were forming within the line of people talking to one another and supporting one another. And really, we were all here to wait for Giselle, but we're also all here for one another. It was quite surprising. I thought it was going to be only bleak, but there was this really surprising sorority.
And you write about how you found sisterhood. Explain.
Yeah, so yeah, I was very distraught going there, distraught while watching the rape videos. I'd originally intended to go later on so that they wouldn't be showing the videos, but they ran late and I ended up watching, sitting through them. But the woman next to me was as distraught as I was, and she grabbed my hand as we watched the videos, and that was quite extraordinary. She didn't let go until the video stopped playing, and then everyone, all of the women attending. It's a small town, and there's only a small break for lunch, so we all go to try and eat something, despite what we've seen, at the same restaurants, the same boulangeries in Avignon. And we stuck together all day, and that was quite extraordinary.
Can you talk about the issue of consent and talk about French law and how people are trying to change it now, and also men's responses to this? Because let's be clear, that website Coco, where the husband recruited all these rapists, which, by the way, were her neighbors, people she would pass in the street, she had no idea. Mm-hmm. But Coco was shut down, wasn't it, by an LGBTQ group, because they saw that gay men were being ambushed, recruited to ambush gay men on that site. It wasn't shut down by her case.
No, it very much wasn't. And even though her case came out in 2021, it was only later that it was shut down. But yeah, on the issue of consent, it's quite tricky. We don't have consent explicitly written into French law. what qualifies a rape and what has qualified a rape since the late 80s is a sexual act performed via either constraint, menace, or surprise. And so obviously questions of consent come in to illustrate and sort of try and understand more of that, but it has to be proven that the act was committed by constrained violence or menace or surprise. And consent not being written in is very important because in French criminal law, and that includes rape law, the main issue is intent. And so to prove that you've not committed a theft or a homicide, you can try to prove that you didn't intend to commit a theft or a homicide. And it's the same for rape. If you can argue that you didn't intend to commit a rape, you might get a lower sentence. And so a lot of these men tried very hard to exploit that flaw. One of them was quoted saying, you know, I didn't know what consent was before this case, but thank you, Madame Pellicot, you've taught me about consent, and once the court frees me, I will create a seminar where I teach other men about consent. And so a lot of them were able to say also that they thought that she'd given consent because her husband said that she had. And so it's very, very tricky. Feminist activists are very, very divided on the issue of whether adding consent to the law would be better or not. They say, some of them say that it might put too much weight on the victim to prove that she was not consenting, rather than on the perpetrator to say that he didn't ask for her consent, that it might actually not be that helpful to women to add consent to the law, because you might get situations like this man who was saying that, you know, he didn't know about consent, and so he obviously is not his fault that he raped her. He did not intend to rape her. It was an accidental rape. That's the sentence I was uttered in court, accidental rape.
And it may be that Pellicot is a murderer as well, is that right?
Yes.
That his DNA has been matched to a cold case in Paris from something like 10 years ago.
Very much. And a rape case in Paris as well, which is why, you know, some people are very iffy with the case being described as the Mazon rape trial, because even on Gisèle herself, not all the rapes were committed in Mazon. He had her raped in a car by the sidewalk. He had her raped in a car in her bedroom in their daughter's beach house. It's not all about that one town of Mazon.
And there were even pictures of her daughter found who said, I don't know this underwear I'm in.
Exactly.
My father raped me, and he insists he didn't.
Yeah, so the kids of Gisèle say that the one who's really been forgotten and left out of this trial is the daughter, because, yes, there's pictures of her naked in her father's hard drive wearing underwear that she doesn't recognize, and she is convinced, and she's arguing, and she's founded an association to support people like her, who she says she's been raped, she says she's been chemically subdued. But unlike Gisèle, there's not a single video, and so you can't prove anything.
Well, Diane de Vignemont, we thank you so much for being with us. French journalist who covered the Pellicot trial in Avignon, France. We'll link to her piece in New Lines magazine headline, Gisèle Pellicot, Finding Sisterhood at France's Mass Rape Trial. Next up, we go to Bethlehem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Stay with us.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met.
Nat King Cole singing O Little Town of Bethlehem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Palestine, where Christians are preparing for a second Christmas under ongoing Israeli attacks, as the number killed in Gaza has risen to 45,317, though the toll is likely so much higher. In the past 24 hours alone, dozens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes in Gaza. On Friday, the Palestinian theologian and pastor, Reverend Munta Isaac, delivered a Christmas sermon at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, an occupied West Bank, the birthplace of Jesus, called Christ is Still in the Rubble. He'll join us in a minute. First, this excerpt of his address.
never again should mean never again to all peoples. Never again has become yet again. Yet again to supremacy. Yet again to racism. And yet again to genocide. And sadly, never again has become yet again for the weaponization of the Bible and the silence and complicity of the Western Church. Yet again for the church siding with power, the church siding with the empire. And so today, after all this of total destruction and annihilation, and Gaza is erased, unfortunately, millions have become refugees and homeless, tens of thousands killed. And why is anyone still debating whether this is a genocide or not? I can't believe it. Yet even when church leaders simply call for investigating whether this is a genocide, he is called out and it becomes breaking news. Friends, the evidence is clear. Truth stands plain for all to see. The question is not whether this is a genocide. This is not the debate. The real question is, why isn't the world and the church calling it a genocide? It says a lot when you deny and ignore and refrain from using the language of genocide. This says a lot. It actually reveals hypocrisy. For you lectured us for years on international laws and human rights. It reveals your hypocrisy. It says a lot on how you look at us Palestinians. It says a lot about your moral and ethical standards. It says everything about who you are when you turn away from the truth, when you refuse to name oppression for what it is. Or could it be that they're not calling it a genocide? Could it be that if reality was acknowledged for what it is, that it is a genocide, then that it would be an acknowledgement of your guilt? For this war was a war that was so many defended as just and self-defense. And now you can't even bring yourself to apologize. We said last year, Christ is in the rubble. And this year we say, Christ is still in the rubble. The rubble is his manger. Jesus finds his place with the marginalized, the tormented, the oppressed, and the displaced. We look at the Holy Family and see them in every displaced and homeless family living in despair. In the Christmas story, even God walks with them and calls them his own. So today, let us reflect on the child Jesus, the child of Bethlehem. At the heart of the incarnation, there is a child. And this child, in his weakness, he is our hope. He is our consolation. He is our strength. This child, let us remember, this child shook Herod's throne when he was born. And while there are some who talk about their Roman Empire or glorify Herod as great, we are the ones who sing of a child born to refugees escaping a massacre. Yes, it has been 440 days. It is 440 days of Palestinians' resilience, Sumud. Indeed, it is 76 years of Sumud. But we have not and will not lose hope. Yes, it is 76 years of an ongoing Nakba, but it is also 76 years of Palestinian Sumud, clinging to our rights and justice of our cause. 76 years of praying and singing for peace. I was thinking about it. We are stubborn people. We continue to pray for peace year after year after year and sing about peace, and we will continue to do so. And we will continue to echo the words of the angels, glory to God in the highest, peace on earth.
Excerpts of this year's Christmas sermon from Pastor Reverend Isaac Munther at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank in Palestine. Reverend Isaac's forthcoming book is titled Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. The Pope has repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. He also unveiled this year's nativity scene at the Vatican, portraying a baby Jesus in a crib lined with a Palestinian keffiyeh. The Israeli government has now denounced the Pope for calling for an international inquiry into Israel's assault on Gaza to see if it constitutes a genocide. The pastor, Munther Isaac, is joining us now from occupied Bethlehem. Your thoughts on what's happening, on the Pope being condemned by Israel, on what's happening in Bethlehem, the second year that Christmas activities have been canceled because of the more than 45,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. Reverend Isaac, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Well, if Israel was true that they are engaging within the rules of wars, then why should they be concerned if anyone, not just the Pope, calls for investigation into whether war crimes are taking place or not? Israel is clearly committing a genocide. I mean, the evidence is very clear. And of course, they should be concerned because if an investigation takes place, it's going to reveal truly what is taking place. And even here in Bethlehem, it's not easy. It's another Christmas with isolation, with Bethlehem being completely isolated from Bethlehem, more blockades, more gates, checkpoints outside of Bethlehem. And my fear and our fear here in Bethlehem is that there is no one who's going to hold Israel accountable. And that's why statements like this from His Holiness the Pope make a difference, because Israel needs to know that we live within a community that respects the rule of law. Otherwise, chaos will prevail if everyone just does what they can. And if the rule of might is right rules, then is this the kind of future we want to leave for our children?
Reverend Isaac, we spoke to you in our studio in New York. You came here to New York. You went to Washington, D.C., as the Biden administration wraps up and President Trump is about to become president again, what are you demanding of the United States?
That it respects the international law. I mean, it cannot be the United States and Israel versus the rest of the world, as every United Nations vote reveals. Again, if the United States is honest about its call for freedom, ideals, human rights, then they should respect that and that they should abide by the international law. My message is that they are enabling Israel into politics that's leading the whole region into chaos and destruction. There can be other ways. There are other ways. And we're tired and sick of these wars, which are enabled by American tax money and American politics.
Tell us more about Christ in the rubble and that image that you created in the manger last year that you continue this year. We said well over 45,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza. Close to 800 have died in the West Bank under Israeli assault. Talk about the situation where you are.
Yeah, I mean, we're still seeing images of children pulled from under the rubble. It's unthinkable to me that it's been more than 14 months now into this genocide, and we're still seeing the same images. It seems like we're powerless, and it seems like the world is content with letting this go on. And here in the West Bank, as we watch from Bethlehem what's happening, or Ramallah, or Hebron, we wonder, are we next? Israel has made it clear they plan to annex the West Bank next year. What would this mean on the ground? Again, we live in this moment of anticipation, of anxiety. And at the same time, we're broken by the fact that the world seems content with letting this go without serious efforts to make it stop or put accountability and restraint on those who commit war crimes.
Reverend Munther Isaac, we thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in occupied Bethlehem, where his Christmas sermon this year was titled, Christ is Still in the Rubble. He was speaking to us from Palestine. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Yusra Razuki. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Geister, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenup, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, you also earn a ticket for one of our weekly raffle draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
You're listening to CFRC. This is Charlotte Cardin.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. I'm your host, Claire, and you're listening to Earworm. So I know I have been slacking in posting a new episode. I've been doing finals and exams and stuff, so that's why I haven't come out with a new episode.